The particular fungi that I studied are in 60 to 80% of all plant species. So if you were to go and dig up a plant species, any plant, the likelihood of you finding these fungi is 80%. That's what's so fascinating about it, is that something so small can be so abundant. Probably the most abundant mutualism on Earth, this symbiosis between plants and fungi. If you were able to go underground and see what is beneath your feet, it would be this vast network of fungal hyphae. An example, 1 gram of soil, so a thimbleful. There's kilometers of hyphae in that thimbleful of soil. So you have a host plant that is typically infected by multiple strains of this certain kind of fungi. And this fungi is about 450 million years old. So this is way before the evolution of vertebrates or invertebrates. The colonization of land by plants was facilitated by these fungi. The fungi were able to infect the plant roots on one end, but also help get nutrients from the rocks as the plants were trying to come out of an aquatic environment. And how the symbiosis works is that the plant is infected by these strains of fungi that are all foraging in the soil to obtain nutrients, mostly phosphorus and nitrogen. And in exchange for these nutrients that the fungi give the host plant gives carbohydrates, so sugars, very simple sugars that the fungi can use.
I ended up in a synthetic organic chemistry lab. I would compare it to cooking rather than anything else. You just go into the lab, you cook for 6-7 hours a day, you come out and that's it. I was actually making new compounds that's never been made before. If you stumble across the right structure that looks like sugar but it's not a sugar, the body will think that it's a sugar but cannot metabolize it. So it potentially has all sorts of biochemical pathway implications.
Most physics experiments are very boring. You can't see much happening. Masses of equipment and wiring and dials. And whereas lasers are really beautiful and you can see things, they're very interesting. These are quite powerful lasers that are visible lasers, so typically green or red or blue and in a single frequency, very bright light of a single frequency of a very pure color, in other words, is very unusual. We don't encounter that in much in our everyday life. And the way then that light interacts with its surroundings is amazing as well, because it scatters in a way that normal light doesn't scatter, and it creates patterns in your retina that are interference patterns that you don't get with normal light.
I guess my fascination for money has two roots. On the one hand, it is mysterious because it's pretty intangible. You know, it seems different than so many other things that you could study if you're interested in the economy. You know, it's different than car tires, it's different than houses, you know, the fleeting quality to money that also from an intellectual perspective that makes it more challenging. The other thing is that money is obviously something that is very powerful or that is used by people who are very powerful, is used to great effect. I mean, it's a very powerful nervous system of societies. We like money because it holds the promise of wish fulfillment and it hasn't had the chance yet to disappoint us.
There's sort of big mergers in pharmaceutical companies. The first area of overlap is research. You know, you could be a really, really good scientist and work in a really, really good company, and bang goes a merger and you're kind of out.
The read across to finance and the sort of reaction to seeing options and complicated things like that for the first time was more that geeky side of things. It's not that the equations were beautiful or anything. It was just, oh, this is fun. You know, rather than just a simple, do I own this asset or don't I? I can do lots more interesting things by combining the asset with the options. It sort of opens up a world of possibilities. And it's sort of quite interesting, quite geeky, and trying to figure out the interplay of things and the drivers of it. Just appeal to that side of it. But I really like the idea that they had a real world application, that I could envisage having a job which was basically about these things. That seemed to me amazing.
There was then a great sucking sound as both people and monies were drawn into banking. in particular the high-risk, high-return, sharp-suited parts such as investment banking. A generation of scientists' and mathematicians' heads was turned towards finance. Industries outside of finance were starved of sunlight.
It's a pretty playful environment. So a million was a buck, you know, billion was a yard. It's not even like you're using real terms, right? So it is like monopoly money.
And so what emerges is basically a market where the host plant is allocating resources to the partner offering the best deal. And reciprocally, the fungi are evaluating their hosts and allocating resources to the best host plant that gives them the most sugar.
He thinks one of the problems is jargon, and that the jargon is not uniform. So when regulators speak to banks, banks speak to each other, nobody really knows what anybody else means. And that if we all spoke the same language, that would have avoided a lot of the problems.
A common language has been found to increase dramatically bilateral trade between countries by more than 40%. It has been found to increase bilateral investment between two countries by a factor of three or more.
I don't know, I might define leverage as one thing. Now, that's a basic concept, leverage or gearing. I know what I mean by it, but there isn't a universal definition of it. If I'm talking to a counterpart in another organization, they can very rightly define it a slightly different way.
The whole credit chain was immersed in fog.
These are beautiful thoughts, and he's got a point there. But again, here also we have to think about how these things come about. There might be an interest that I have as a particular agent in a network to create a language that's somewhat different that my customer doesn't really understand what's going on.
If we made a new compound, we had to do all the tests because you cannot see it. It's just powder, but you have to do all the tests to prove that you've made that compound, but there's nothing in the market for this. So that's what got me uncomfortable.
You know, these products are complicated. You can think about them for days and try and figure out the best way to price them and the best way to hedge the risk.
Whatever price you want it to be, I can reverse engineer a model for you to get that price because it's just numbers. Now, the market's saying this, but the trader's saying that. Who's right? Who's right?
There was certainly an interest in being innovative and clever. You know, where the product started and where it finished were two very different places. We were amazed at how quickly the product grew. A derivative is inherently a leveraged product. When you create leverage, you increase return.
Funky finance.
There was a real push to originate credit risk that maybe, had you been forced to hold it yourself, you wouldn't have been so keen to originate. And there was a real demand from investors and, as a result, pressure on these teams in various different financial institutions to create product, and then pressure on them to find product, pressure on originators to originate product. You can see so easily how it can all go wrong because everybody else is doing it. These other businesses are so profitable. How can we not be involved? How can we not be out there? And the investors are asking for it. Let's just do it. Those were fun. Those were fun periods. Regrets. Gosh, that's... what would I regret? Maybe not recognizing, to some extent, what would I regret? I have no idea. I don't really run around with that many regrets. I think I had a great run. I have no idea. I don't run around with a lot of regrets. I had a good time.
Not only that, everything I did was within the rules. And then that calls very attracted to any theory or any value system which says not only within the rules, but it was also good. No personal regrets. Yes, the whole system went wrong, but the blame lies elsewhere. Well, and of course, you know, to some extent, I think that's not, it's not crazy. It's not deluded of them to think that. I think it's true that the fault was systemic. It actually continues to be.
So we've got this evolutionary dilemma where it really pays for a particular fungi to defect from its duties. A major question in our research is trying to understand why the whole system doesn't fall apart. If it pays so much for a fungi to defect, why don't all of the fungal strains defect and then the symbiosis could fall apart, regardless that it's 450 million years old?
You know, I think that governments, policymakers, others are equally to blame. One reason is because it was seen as being anti-capitalist, anti the people. Who are we to tell somebody that they can't borrow more money? I remember my unemployed sister and brother-in-law at one point in the States owning two houses, two large houses. So how is that possible? How have you managed to do that? Well, it wasn't hard. It was very easy.
You take the debt away and the house isn't worth half as much. But that some people didn't realize.
Why were they allowed to do that?
A lot of what's happened since the global financial crisis has disproportionately affected the 99% versus the 1%. And a lot of the measures that have been in place to help the financial system recover has actually benefited the owners of capital. Very low interest rates, quantitative easing, unorthodox monetary policy. It was supposed to help the real economy and therefore broad swathes of society, but it probably hasn't. You may not have been able to do anything else, but you've exacerbated the problem.
It's called the centipede game only because it looks like a centipede. And what it's meant to be is a game of how small amounts of trust can build a big bubble of trust. So the trust is that Adam takes this open-ended risk. He sacrifices 1 cent, and that 1 cent that he sacrifices is worth $1 to Eve. He knows there's nothing he can do to stop Eve walking away with it, except trust that she sees that it makes sense for them all to keep going until this value grows. As long as you make the steps that trust requires small enough, then you can build up this very big bubble of trust. I suspect that there's lots of this kind of stuff going on in financial markets. If you think of something like the LIBOR rigging, where someone has to do some very small thing, and that if they do that very small thing, the other participants in the rigging ring could walk away with the small amount of advantage that it brings. But if instead of that, they move it on past this parcel, as it were, and allow it to build, you actually get from these very small moves something that becomes financially very significant.
In human systems, very often you can build relationships of trust, or sometimes there's the option you'll know that someone will take revenge on you in another context if you don't behave in a cooperative manner. And so that gives you an incentive to behave cooperatively and build up trust.
So perfect rationality with zero trust, with zero collusion, with zero buddiness, leads to very poor outcomes from the point of view of the participants.
In biology, there's no such psychological mechanism available, or sometimes the immediate interaction is life or death. And so we'd come to the conclusion that cooperation is never favored in biology. And that gives us our immediate paradox, because cooperation is all around us.
I often think about the circles of people, the very strong cultures of knowing who you're dealing with. The cultures and the ways of being, I think, were very much set. There is a dominant culture and you fit into it, whatever your background. You know very well that there are endless occasions where you've had to simply just trust what they're going to do and pass it on to them, knowing that they might drop it, that it might not work, but that eventually you'll get to an overall outcome that is good for everyone. And it's kind of fundamental in the way that team sports work, and is one of the really important things about team sports in education, which is that you're always making this kind of passing move where you're giving something to someone else. It's a small cost to you because you give up the individual glory. It's a small benefit to them because they have the possibility of that individual glory. But you keep passing until someone scores. And then there's an overall benefit to them, there's an overall benefit to you, there's a team benefit, etc. So all these rituals that prepare you to go in for this kind of behavior. And this kind of behavior is the sort of behavior which also leads to fraud, to being able to operate outside the law, and to creating financial bubbles.
Economic systems are very complex systems which don't have a fundamental underlying framework through which we understand them. And then you have life, which is an even more complex system. But because we have a basic logic of natural selection leading to changes in the composition of life, we can actually very effectively predict what life is going to look like under certain circumstances in the future. And also we can explain why life is organized as it is.
So we have this one fungus that we call a cheater that is very clever, because what we think it's able to do is it goes into the soil and it takes up the phosphorus, but rather than giving it right away to the host, it stores the phosphorus in a form that is unavailable to the host plant. And so basically what it's doing is it's scavenging the phosphorus, taking it away from all the other fungi, putting it into a form that's inaccessible, so that eventually what we think is that the host becomes incredibly dependent on this fungi because it's the only one that has phosphorus left. So basically it's taking up the resources and waiting to get a higher price rather than the other fungi who are just taking it up and giving it right away to the host plant in exchange for sugars. That's one of the best cheating strategies I've seen in fungi so far.
It's not immediately obvious why we should think that game theory will be applicable to biology, because of course, for example, a microbe doesn't really have these long, complex thought processes for, oh, what should I do? Should I, you know, produce this extracellular enzyme, which is a weapon which will kill every cells, or should I not? So we have to return to the logic of natural selection to figure this out, because natural selection leads to only the individuals that are best at surviving and reproducing being represented in populations in the long term. And so we can think that natural selection will lead to organisms that, whatever their lifestyle is, find the very best way of fulfilling that ecological niche. And so actually, biological organisms are far better strategists because they're under this life and death pressure of natural selection than humans. They very reliably find the solutions to games. So even though they're not consciously optimizing, a process of natural selection leads to individuals that look as if they were attempting to maximize their survival and reproduction.
There must be some sort of mechanism that stabilizes cooperation. So the goal of our lab is to try to understand what stabilizes cooperation. How have these organisms managed for such an incredibly long evolutionary history to be involved in this very, very intimate relationship and not become overrun by cheaters?
And so if you can manipulate the chemical signals that a plant is getting as a mycorrhizal fungus, then you can receive carbon without handing any phosphorus. But of course, if all individuals did that, then plants would be extremely favored to develop these foolproof signaling systems. It wouldn't make any sense to attempt to be a cheating mycorrhizal fungus, because all the plants would have such a good cheat detection system that it would be ineffective. And so what that means is that the frequency of cheaters in the system is greater than zero, because if there were none, then the plants would invest nothing in trying to detect cheats, and therefore cheats would do better than cooperators. But it's capped at a low level, because if there were too many, then the plants would invest heavily into detecting cheats, and cheating strategies would be ineffective. And so it's in fact cheating that maintains cooperation, and cooperation that maintains cheating.
Out of the hundreds of thousands of models everyone is running, there are some models who are set up for cheating. Now, let's not be naive. I can't quantify them, but we have the task to search for them. If you see something in the market which is suspect, you have the obligation to report it.
Parts of the system are very perverse, extremely perverse. And you see news all the time of actors being caught out doing naughty things. And it's very, very difficult to catch them out.
I think to keep the ecosystem clean, we all have that duty.
There is HFT, high frequency trading. This is a subset of algorithmic traders that trade for their own pocket. In the simplest terms, you want to buy at a little lower price than you sell at, and then you pocket some money. It might not even be cents, but fractions of cents. But this is a volume business, so you scale it by massive amounts that you trade along the way. The other part of algorithmic trading is agency traders. If there's competition in this sector, the costs of running these algorithms are lower, if not close to zero.
Listen to the defendants, and they say, oh, it produces much needed liquidity. The only times when markets run out of liquidity are the times when you've got a real crisis on your hands. And I don't think that high frequency trading is going to produce liquidity at those times. You've got the old story about the original Rothschild racing pigeon coming back from Waterloo with the news.
These machines run a sub-millisecond today.
It's just an evolution from faster and faster pigeons to getting closer and closer to the exchange.
Between New York and Philadelphia, there was a flag system. I think there were 19 top of the hills between Philly and New York where flagmen were signaling the orders through. That was faster than pigeons. If you buy the top of the hill in the old days, you could put your own flagmen there and no one else would be allowed. Again, you monopolize it. These days, microwave towers are everywhere.
We don't do cables anymore because they're too slow. We're now moving the light signal through the air because it's quicker. And so you see towers everywhere.
It's an expensive business, but if it's good for your business model, you can get there.
Like if you think in evolutionary terms in economics, right now what has been selected on is time, the fastest amount of time, right? And now we've gotten to a point where time doesn't even become a variable because it's so fast. What is the next pressure that's going to shape the economics market, right? If it's not time, then it's probably processing of vast amounts of information. Exactly.
For market makers who need to transfer the risk very quickly and take in the data very quickly, for some of them it's work.
There's a real solid economic rationale for market making type algorithms to be the fastest in the market.
It's a very similar situation where you have a plant in the ground and it's colonized by a huge network of fungi. And these fungi connect to other different plants. And there's constant trading of resources. The fungi is giving phosphorus to the plant, and the plant is giving it sugars. They all give different amounts of sugars and different amounts of phosphorus. So what we're trying to understand is if you have this network underground of, let's say, just an individual fungi that's connected to 10 different plants, how is it able to make decisions?
We've been trying to see if we can predict how the nutrients move through networks and what are the most efficient ways of moving nutrients through a network, and do the fungi follow these rules, and can we learn anything about how these networks form and transport nutrients, because potentially that's very important for scaling up to, for instance, our own transport systems, subway systems, things where there's very complicated networks where goods need to be moved across them.
The one thing we do today a lot is to use fertilizers to grow all of our crops. The plant needs the fungi for trading, and suddenly you add a lot of fertilizers to the ground, and suddenly the plant thinks, why do I need a fungi at all? And the fungi thinks, well, I don't have more carbon sources because no plant's interested in trading with me. So instead of using like fertilizers to compensate for the lack of nutrients, what if we enhance or improve this collaboration between plant and fungi?
Together we're an ecosystem, and the ecosystem is and needs to stay in balance. If we run the ecosystem, it won't be good. So that's a market maker. If you have a broker run the ecosystem, it's not good. If it's just an exchange, it won't work either. If it's just a bank, it won't work either. You need the parties, and you need to have balance between the parties. If all the banks fall under some kind of new regulation and they're less active, that's an imbalance in the ecosystem. And that could create illiquidity in the market, that could create more volatility in the market, that could create wider spreads, whereby the average pensioner is way worse off.
We are trying to always minimize loss of either time or minimize costs. And these fungi are doing this for 400 million years.
They explore space in a way that we don't understand yet. They have lots of different strategies for gathering nutrients. There are some hyphae that go straight ahead very, very fast. And rather than exploring the space immediately around them, they just shoot forward and try to enter into a new space. And there's also different hyphae that shoot off from the runner hyphae and colonize very small area. And they basically form dense mats where they start to collect the nutrients.
You can ask yourself, why does a particular network take the shape it has? What we saw with Lehman, one bank was so critical for all the banks trading and positions and books that you take out that particular bank, everything goes. Part of that is a network that might not have been so stable as we thought, because there's so much interdependence.
in our analysis, what we essentially show is that this mutualism is extraordinarily stable. So it evolved at least 350 million years ago and potentially earlier. And still to this day, a vast majority of species still retain it. So that probably means it's really important, right? Because if a trait like mycorrhizal interactions is maintained in evolution for such a long period of time, that usually means that it's really fundamental.
It's basically like trying to create a system where you allow enough competition, but that there's also some social aspect to it so that the competition doesn't get out of control. You want competition to flourish, yet you want to have some sort of ultimate regulation so that society benefits.
Regulation should foster competition. Competition, actually, is the fairest possible model for people to be rewarded to help society.
Yeah, we see the exact same thing in natural selection. The more competition there is, the more innovation. We see organisms evolving incredibly complex designs just in order to stay in the game. And there's no limit to that. That's the diversity of life. But you're saying that we want to foster competition, but at some point, there has to be regulation. There has to be some sort of control over the ability to innovate. That just seems like such a big decision. I mean, that's a global population decision. How on earth would you ever be able to decide when competition is becoming too unfair?
We have folks who trade with automated Excel spreadsheets, and you've got people maybe do it the real high frequency way, which is through microwave towers. Everyone is in its own niche. The competition is extreme. Even within firms, it's extreme. When I used to be on the floor, I would stand in the pit and would just yell a price, and it was the only pit I could be in. But if I sit behind my desk and I control my computer system, I could trade around the world, and I could trade maybe 1,000 models. And all these models generate prices and generate orders. You're your own competitor, if you like, within the firm.
There's a tendency to kill everything around us, competition we don't like. And so we grow so big and we just crush everything else. One particular company grows so big, there's no room for competition. They lose all the incentives to give us all a fair price, or they stop innovating.
That is actually how natural selection works. At no point is it going to have a check on itself. It's the drive of natural selection to consume as many resources as possible. So that's why it's so different from human systems, is there's no checks and balances. So that organism could reach a peak, and this is what we see all the time with fitness landscape, where you've got an organism where the fitness is increasing, 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 and then it gets to what we call a fitness peak, and then it starts going down because there's no forethought in evolution. So that instead you have other organisms that are going to come in right as that organism is at its fitness peak and take over the decline.
Maybe we should clock the market at speeds that are well understood for everybody. Auctions every 100 milliseconds. This would still be a super fast market at the clock speed of humans. But you would reduce the arms race that is just not producing any social value or economic value. By upgrading our systems, we're not helping society in any way. We're not producing more liquidity or more quotes. We're just in an arms race that's costing money.
One of the big avenues in game theory is, what if you essentially have robotic agents playing games? What you then have is a world in which the robots try and figure out what the robots are doing and try and find the flaws in what the robots are doing. You then have a sort of evolutionary race amongst the robots. And they get more and more complicated as they try and figure out how to win against the previous generation of robots. The work that I was involved with looks at where things end up. Are there any stable points in these races of robots? The results seem to be that there's nothing particularly good about where these systems might end up. In fact, they can get stabilized in very bad places. They can go off into hugely speculative equilibria. Mostly in economics, if you want to generate speculative equilibria, so bubbles, what you do is you limit the amount of processing power and memory that your agents have.
We watch whether the fungi, for instance, go left for phosphorus or right for nitrogen, and whether the decisions that the fungi makes depends on the conditions that the host is growing in. Now, we have no idea how the host could control the behavior of the fungi, whether it's through signaling or preferential allocation of sugars. But what we suspect is that the fungi are going to preferentially forage for the nutrients that the host needs most. And we do this by tracking individual fungi, which is actually incredibly hard because these fungi are very, very small. You can almost see them with the naked eye, but they look like very fine pieces of hair, much, much thinner than human hair.
If I trade from home through a broker, the broker doesn't need to have a microwave tower. The broker is fast enough just by fiber optic cables. But if I would be a market maker, and it's my profession to maintain prices, I might choose to buy a tower.
Because humans are interacting with each other through these machines, but in the inner circle of trading in the most advanced securities markets, there's machines interacting with each other, steered by humans, true, but it's machines interacting.
It's still the humans that are making the decision to change the code of the algorithms. The algorithms themselves are not incorporating the information and changing the algorithms.
Of course, there's learning coded into the algorithms, but it's deterministic. At some point, somebody decided this is the way machines should learn. Out of this vast amount of information, you want to generate the signal of where the price is going to go, up or down, and then you trade on it. Now, there's tons of models that one can use, but all these models exploit some kind of similarity of the market conditions now and the market conditions somewhere in history. There's these dark spots where the market's showing something that we don't have history for. What is the rational response of the algorithm? How have they been coded? Stop. Move out. I don't understand it anymore. And then other algorithms pull out, and all of a sudden, we have a vacuum.
In economics, you need some sort of bigger regulatory body that at some point can come in and stop in an instant that kind of trading. And that's what's so different in nature, is that you could be headed down a particular path, but there's never any omniscient regulatory body that can put a stop to evolution. As humans, there's always a regulatory body that can come in and break up any sort of path in nature. There's nothing like that, which is why we get so much diversity in the first place. There's never any stop to that path. It's just death. It's very dramatic.
We're blessed with a regulator here, particularly in Holland, but there's a few more in Europe as well who really work with deep learning methods to catch these things early.
The mind reels at the waste of talent that goes into this stuff. If it's of no social value, which I believe it isn't, then why are all these really highly skilled, very, very intelligent people being put to use on this stuff? That seems to me to be the really devastating waste of it. They should be working on energy and climate change. They've got real skills to contribute to the problems of the world, and the speed of trading is not one of the world's number one problems.
I would say the social purpose of a financial market is to permit the efficient allocation of capital. So there are owners of capital and there are users of capital who need that capital. And financial markets exist from a social construct to facilitate that exchange, right?
Transformation towards electronification happened relatively recently, but it's all meant to make life smoother and cheaper. So humans are at the steering wheel, so they'll still steer those machines, but it's meant to make trading cheaper.
We are innovative and we've changed the world. That's very hard for people to accept, but because the costs have gone down dramatically, you can really trade now for so much less.
In the best possible world, the financial security of you and me is much better, because algorithms help us store money at the right times in the right products so that our pensions are generally better.
I'd be much happier to accept lower liquidity, higher transaction costs, and achieve a more transparent system that's easier to understand and is clearly fulfilling its social function, because I think it's then sustainable.
It's brought a huge benefit to the end user.
On average, we don't slow them down, at least not at the moment. There's some proposals floating around to do it, but there's a lot of resistance. Is there a major problem? Potentially, because every now and then markets crash. Nobody likes crashes, in particular if you're in the midst of it trading.
While we're talking about transparency of the market and transparency of pricing, I think with the new rules in place, MiFID II, we have to be very careful that we don't lose oversight of price formation. So that is transparency. I am a believer in lit markets, which basically means they're all out there. Everyone can see them at the same time. Complete transparency.
seems to me absolutely clear-cut case of insider trading, or certainly why one tries to get rid of insider trading. What eventually it tells people is that these markets are markets that work very well for insiders and don't work for anyone else. And in the end, they dry up the markets. They do the opposite of providing liquidity. They actually just mean that any knowledgeable outsider takes their money out and does something else with it. And what that means these days is that ordinary savers think, OK, I can't trust these markets. They're clearly rigged. Let me go and do something like put my savings into a house. And then you have this absolutely stupid situation in which people are doing very inefficient DIY investing.
If people see these crashes more often, they might not want to trade as much or even completely refrain from trading. That's potentially the beginning of the end. If people start pulling out their money, their savings from securities markets, from capital markets, and put them in the alt sock, let's say, it will become more expensive for firms to find capital to grow. If firms can't grow, there's no employment. If there's no employment, there'll be economic contraction with political instabilities. I realize I'm creating the most dramatic picture. But it's not without some probability, because in some sense, 2008 was a time when the global instability, political instabilities, all began with people pulling out of financial markets.
I think the economy has healed much better than we might have expected at the time. For sure, there are still imbalances in the world. There are still things to worry about in the world. But I think broadly speaking, we're in a much better position than we dared to hope we would be at that time. It felt a lot bleaker than the outcome has actually been.
Getting everyone regulated, that was the first big step. Quite a few market makers, liquidity providers, did not have to be regulated. Under MiFID, everyone's regulated. If market makers are the main source of liquidity, you need to regulate them. The data you can store, you can see what we do, and then you know exactly who to catch if someone does something wrong. In FX, you see this every day, because the regulation is not adapted by the FX world. They've got a self-built code of conduct. Self-regulation doesn't work in this industry. Absolutely not.
Merrill Lynch was just caught cheating. They told clients they were doing one thing in their dark pool, and they were actually doing a different thing, and a thing that clients didn't want them to do, which was channeling their orders to hedge funds and other so-called statistical arbitrage players. I can see how the activity is profitable for the participants, but what's the benefit to the system of many of these dark pools? So
you have exchange dark pools and private dark pools. An exchange dark pool is by definition more open and more transparent, and the private dark pool isn't.
Those kinds of dark pools are called crossing networks, and I agree there are crossing networks that work properly. And the way they work is I put on the network that I want to sell a large chunk of X, and nobody can see that. Nobody knows that I want to sell a large chunk of X unless they happen to put up that they want to buy a large chunk of X. And then the system connects us.
A bid for something, you want to sell something and you ask for a bid, so the other party already knows what you're up to. That's kind of a private network, which I think has value in it purely because institutional orders can be big and can be market disruptive. So an institution may definitely want to say, I'm not going to put this out in the open. This is such a big order. I will put it out there to a private pool, someone I have a good relationship with and I can trust who treats my order well. But you still can report them real time.
I can just put a normal buy order in. That's called a buy, good till cancel, because it just sits there and I might end up buying something or might not buy something, depending what price I'm looking to buy it at, but it just sits there until I cancel it. There's fill or kill orders, I trade now or the order disappears. These are all standard normal order types that have been around for a long time.
In economics, we understand that all the humans in the systems are trying to essentially make themselves happy, not care about everybody else in general.
The exchanges have invented all these wacky order types that make no sense to anybody and only benefit these high-frequency traders. Why? Because the high-frequency traders generate a lot of the fees for the exchanges. So they're conflicted. It's a mess. There's good, there's bad.
Economically, it's very good to have a dark pool. But it can, and dark pool can never be 90% of the market volume, because then you've lost the whole transparency.
And maybe if there is structural patterns of some behaviors that are costly for everybody else, you know, in economics we call these externalities or negative externalities, they're cheating the system, then maybe they should be paying more.
As long as retail investors aren't exposed to this, there's a sort of a caveat emptor clause that says, look, you institutions, you're big boys. No one's forcing you to trade on these exchanges, so don't do it if you don't like it. Now, if you're a retail investor, we want to shield you from it. But if you're an institutional investor, then it's up to you. And I have some sympathy with that, but it tends to distort the whole market.
And this is what goes by internalizing the externalities they impose on others. So if you want to smoke in a room full of people, maybe you should first pay everybody else before you're going to light a cigarette. And maybe you reconsider smoking. You see, these are pecuniary incentives to avoid bad behaviors.
And regulation is good. I mean, one needs to be regulated. You're trading with money. You need to be careful in the monetary system.
Unfortunately, markets are very, very complex. In many cases, more complex than they need to be. It's very difficult to argue that this complexity benefits the broader system. A system has grown. It grew during a time when we believed that the capitalist system was capable of unleashing great good through the efficient allocation of capital, and that nothing should get in its way. And then we had the global financial crisis. And if you're the Chinese government and you're sitting there thinking, well, I think that argument's just blown up,